Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Randall White. This morning, we're focusing on a natural part of life that we're all doing at this very moment, aging. Some of us are, of course, farther along in the process, but we're all headed in the same direction. Possibly with some good habits and a little help from genetics, we can prolong our youthful days and limit the ailments associated with our later years. Coming up, we'll speak with several experts who can help us understand where the science is on some key aspects of aging, including Alzheimer's disease and memory loss, how our diets affect longevity, and the important role of family caregivers in our society. But first up, to help us really, I guess, set the table for this discussion is Kim McCoy-Wade. She's the director at the California Department of Aging. Yes, there's a California Department of Aging, which oversees many programs related to services we may depend on later in life. She's also the person responsible for carrying out California's new master plan for aging, which is where we want to start. Director McCoy-Wade, thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for convening this conversation.
Yeah, well, what do the models show regarding California's population? Are we shifting to an older demographic?
Yes, we have one of the longest life expectancies in California. And of course, I have to acknowledge this is before COVID. So COVID has had a devastating and continues to have a devastating impact on older Californians among so many of us. But yes, California is aging and aging is changing our families, our communities, and our state. And that's what caused the master plan to be ordered by the governor and hundreds of people to have worked on it the past 2 years, despite and indeed because of the pandemic, and to release it this month.
Yeah, I was wondering about that. Planning is almost always a good thing, right? But what was it about this specific topic that the state felt there needed to be this master plan? Were we missing opportunities, or were certain groups of people falling through the cracks?
Absolutely. I mean, when you think about what's happened over the last generation, where life expectancy has grown longer and longer and longer, there really is whole new chapters of our life ahead of us. So put it into some data terms. It used to be that about 15% of Californians were over 60. We're headed to a quarter of us being over 60. And that does change your family life. It changes work. There's more older adults in the workplace, volunteering. It changes the kind of housing mix that people might want. They might want I might want multi-generational housing as I age. I might want a duplex behind my kids as they age. At some point, I might want to live into a residential setting with some more support. So really thinking about how does life work at the personal level, the family level, the community level, as you travel from 60, 70, 80, 90, and increasingly to 100. Those are all very different stages of life. And we want to have a state that is really friendly to every single one of those stages.
Yeah, you mentioned that this was rolled out during a pandemic, although it's been worked on well before the pandemic kicked in. Are there aspects to the plan that address COVID-19 and perhaps any long-haul symptoms that are now showing up in people?
Well, it really taught, I think, two of the ways that we, if you can hope anything comes out of COVID, it's that it's an accelerator for the change that we knew was needed already. So one of the ways is really thinking about how do we help people live in the homes they want to live in as we age. I think we have seen that nursing homes are an important part of the healthcare continuum, but they also have real downsides from infection control. And the more people can have choices about where we live. So again, more housing options, more support. The other big challenge, of course, during COVID has been isolation. You know, we've had to physically isolate, and how do you physically isolate and not socially isolate? And so we have been working on everything from distributing tablets and smart speakers and broadband. A lot of our programs, senior centers, are now doing virtual programming, drive-by services. I mean, in some ways, people think about this with schools a lot, with kids. And in some ways, it's the same thing happening with older services. How do we reinvent to bridge the digital divide and deliver services in new ways? So, and then I think the third piece from COVID, which we knew this too, is how diverse our older population is getting. It's kind of the last population of California to diversify in the same way that the younger population has. Lots of languages spoken, cultural traditions around aging, whether Native American, Chinese American. We're having a webinar today on Black elders tradition. So there's so much richness there, but there's also some discrimination and health disparities to address too. So again, COVID, in some ways we knew this, but boy, oh boy, are we learning the painful lessons of where we have the gaps. And it's been a tragedy that we have to use to power a better way forward.
Director McCoy-Wade, I think I read somewhere on the website that this plan is not going to just collect dust somewhere, that it will actually be used. And I'm wondering how that'll work. So when the state has a plan to build something, you know, whether it be high-speed rail or something much smaller, is this plan going to be baked into just about everything the state does to consider the state's older population?
Well, that's right. I mean, I used to joke, we had an all cabinet work group, all 10 members of the cabinet. And I used to joke with them, my not so secret agenda is that every single one of you have aging on your to-do list at the end of this process, because that's how we're gonna be a California for all. We're gonna be a California for all ages. So the way we wanted to make sure it got action is that yes, it's a 10-year plan with 5 bold goals, right? Health reimagined, housing for all ages and stages, affording aging, a really important issue in California. But we also said, what can we do in the next 2 years? And our cabinet signed off on more than 140 specific two-year. We got 2 years of this legislative cycle, 2 years of our governor's term, 2 years with this new federal partners to work with. And so we're just beginning to knock those down. I mean, again, delivering devices, beginning planning for a new elder justice coordinating group, looking at issues around elder abuse and fraud and exploitation that unfortunately also have shown up during the pandemic. And so as we begin to, and again, this webinar today, to increase our work on equity and aging. So we're starting that work even as we continue to be laser focused on vaccines and infection protection and isolation prevention while we're still in what I hope, as our secretary says, is the fourth quarter of this pandemic.
Even the best, most well-accepted plans need funding, right? So how is this funded? How do we make sure that the goals or the 5 bold goals that are part of this plan get the money they need to come to fruition?
Yeah. Well, the short answer is partnership, and I'll say a couple words about that. So first of all, again, you know, aging is a core part of government because it's a core part of life, and it's a core part of business, and it's a core part of community. So really, it's been a joy to work with people like the State Library Association, which of course works with libraries, with older adults as volunteers and customers, with the State Parks Association, which has older adults as the largest source of volunteers. So it's part of it's been embedding aging, updating people's awareness and understanding of the growing and diversifying demographic. But you're absolutely right. The governor did include bold funding in the budget announced on January to engage with the legislature on stakeholders, a package of investments on Alzheimer's, which is one of the growing and just, you know, very devastating on every level, and a new office of Medicare innovation integration. We're very excited to see what can be done with Medicare to help the middle class afford aging and to partner with, again, the new administration and new Congress to really make progress on Medicare, like we did with the Affordable Care Act on Medicaid. It's time to take on Medicare. So there's great investments there, but I also have to say we wouldn't be where we are if it wasn't for a philanthropic partnership of about 7 or 8 foundations led by Stan Foundation, which partnered to kind of fund the planning process. So we are very grateful for the team that we had of that philanthropic government and in-kind kind of support to launch this effort.
Let's dig into as many of these goals as we can with the time that we have, starting with one of the state's most highly debated topics, I would imagine, housing. How do we make it so that older adults are more secure when it comes to having a place to live?
Yeah, there's no question that housing costs are one of the biggest drivers, along with health costs, in affording aging. And that's very true in California. So I think we're going to look at it again. It's these, how do we have housing for all ages and stages? So, you know, in California, where we have for a long time kind of had a housing and aging conversation about two topics, Prop 13 and staying in the home you bought and nursing homes. But of course, as a quarter of the population is going to be living in a whole bunch of different places, and so is looking for apartments that are near transit so they don't have to maintain a property or drive, frankly. Mm. looking for smaller units near services, looking for that duplex with their generational extended family. We're looking at other states for models like adult family homes, which sometimes have been called adult foster care homes, where you could move in with a family who would help you with some of those daily activity livings, and the state could, and the local government could help pay for those. So I think we want to look at every option. And I'm really pleased with our secretary and our local partners and our governor for saying, we just got to build more affordable, build different, think different, because affording housing is really, no matter what your age, it is really one of the biggest challenges in California. And again, if younger generations are paying for the housing of their older generation family, that's holding that family back and the next generation back. So it really is an issue for all ages.
Health Reimagined is another of the five bold goals. When your department says reimagined, help us understand that.
Sure. So the big opportunity is that most older adults want to stay at home, and that we increasingly recognize that things like healthy food, safety so we don't fall, are part of staying healthy, preventing that clinical intervention, preventing going to the emergency room. Did you know the emergency room is one of the places where geriatric issues get discovered? Even if they're not a traumatic fall or a traumatic car accident, that can be the spot. And so people want to be, can we be at home and have meals delivered? Can we be at home and be in an exercise class at our park down the street? All of those services, can they be provided and paid for through healthcare? Because healthcare knows that's better for you. It's cheaper. It keeps you out of the ER and leads to that that long, happy life, even as our needs change.
Yeah. Inclusion and equity, and as the plan puts it, not isolation, help us understand how this will be worked into the plan moving forward.
Yeah, I think there's a couple different angles on it. One, of course, is straight up ageism. I mean, I have to even tease you a little bit. You said about preserving being youthful. It's not about preserving being youthful. It's about celebrating every age and stage. You know, there are good and bad parts about being 20 too, you know.
Right.
Every decade has its highs and its lows. And so I think, you know, part of it is making sure that we celebrate that age. And there's some cultures in California that are much better about that, that recognize the wisdom of, you see the tribal nations vaccinating their older adults and their language keepers and culture keepers first, because that is so revered and respected. And there's many other examples of that as well. So I think it's that including older adults, not talking down, not kind of assuming that they may be, you know, not tracking or something. You sometimes see it in the workplace with age discrimination about what an older adult could do or versus a younger person, instead of seeing the strengths of all folks. So definitely tackling ageism is part of it. And then, of course, again, the racism in our country, the legacy has meant that people hit older age with different health issues, different income saved up, and a lot of that is determined, unfortunately, by those legacy of racial inequities. So how do we address that so that we don't see one group of people with great long life expectancy and others continuing to have health really decline steeply after 50? We can intervene and we can make a difference. Those things are not set at birth. And then I mentioned elder abuse and elder justice. We've got great leadership from our attorney general, from our governor. We really want to just bring our insurance commissioner, bring all those leaders together and say, how can we make sure we're coordinating? We've got internet fraud, robocalls, in-family issues, lots to work on to make sure that we're safe, even as maybe we're living alone more than we used to as we age, that we are not alone, even if we live alone.
We're going to discuss caregiving pretty extensively later in the show, so I'll skip that goal just because we don't have much time left and go straight to the affording aging. And it's not cheap to get old.
Yeah, I mean, that is maybe the downside of living longer and longer at the same time as pensions have the three-legged stool, right? How many of us have pensions? How many of us have our private savings and Social Security being what it is? So those legs of the stool are getting more and more wobbly, and yet we're asking people to pay for these housing costs and health costs through 100. A system that was meant for you to retire at 65 is now going to carry you through 35 more years.
In a state that's extremely expensive.
On a state that's extremely expensive. And again, what it does to the next generation to begin, of course, loving and caring for their family, but finding the resources. So we really do need a whole new rethink. I was really moved by leadership at University of California, Berkeley, who said the issue is downward mobility, that we have downward mobility beginning as you age. And that's something we can do something about, with that bringing down housing costs, bringing down health costs, and bringing up those base income supports can make the ledger balance out. But right now it is on a downward trend, and we absolutely have to come together as a nation, private sector, and state to address that.
Kit McCoy-Wade is the director at the California Department of Aging. We really appreciate you taking the time to explain the state's plan for us.
Thank you so much for this conversation this morning.
Up next, there are some new advances for treating Alzheimer's disease, and we'll discuss those with a health journalist for AARP. Also, your diet and how it affects longevity. We'll speak with one of the state's top health experts on this topic. If you have a question about diet and aging, shoot us an email, insight@capradio.org. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Randall White, back in just a moment. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. And this morning, our big conversation revolves around aging. And you can't really have a discussion like this without talking about memory issues, including Alzheimer's disease. According to a recent AARP article, more than 5 million Americans are suffering from the condition that, you know, really steals away the very qualities that make us who we are, our memories. But now there is some positive news regarding treatment for this ailment. Health journalist Hallie Levine joins us now to talk a bit about her recent article that digs into some of these scientific breakthroughs. And welcome, Hallie.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Yeah, before we get into the details of these breakthroughs, I want to start with your own personal interest in Alzheimer's research. It's not a parent or a grandparent for you. It's a child.
Yes, yes. My daughter, Johanna, who is 12 years old, has Down syndrome. So that means that she has a significantly increased risk of developing Alzheimer's later in life. We believe that about 50% of people with Down syndrome will develop Alzheimer's by the age of 50. And virtually all of them will have signs of Alzheimer's apparent in their brains by that point. And I think that it's devastating to have that knowledge as a mother, because most of the time we hear about children worrying about their parents developing dementia and how they will take care of them. And in my case, it's the reverse. I wonder, will I be watching my daughter succumb to the ravages of this disease? Or if I'm not around, will it be my sons that will have to take care of her during this time? Right. So this is an issue that is really very near and dear to my heart.
When I talked to you the other day, that came as a huge surprise to me. I had no idea that the percentage was so high. Yeah,
I know. I know. And, you know, they're not quite sure why it is. But one theory is that people with Down syndrome have three copies of the 21st chromosome. That's why it's called trisomy 21. And it's thought that some of the genes that code proteins, they may be responsible. They may sort of go into overdrive and lay down some of these plaques that are the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease.
Why do you think it's been so hard for researchers to come up with effective treatments for Alzheimer's disease?
That is an excellent question. They have had a lot of trouble in the past. One of the reasons actually may be because of the blood-brain barrier.
Can you describe that a bit, the blood-brain barrier, what that means?
Sure, absolutely. It's just basically, you know, drugs have to pass through your brain membrane in order for them to work on your brain. And this may be less permeable than other areas of the body. And the thought is that some of these treatments might actually work, some of the drugs that they're developing, but they just haven't been able to penetrate the blood-brain barrier. And, you know, one of the things that researchers are studying, and this is still very, very much in its infancy, but there's been, last year I did a piece on the Rockefeller Neuroscience Institute at Western Virginia University And basically, they've had patients undergo MRI ultrasounds. And the idea is that you've got these tiny probes that are emitting ultrasound straight to the hippocampus, which is part of the brain. And that basically these microbubbles can crack open the blood-brain barrier. And the thought is eventually they may be able to harness medications through ultrasound that can actually penetrate this barrier.
So what are some go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. But that I think is quite further down the road. But I think what is so exciting is we have so much research already going on for some new drug treatments that are basically taking a new way of looking at Alzheimer's disease. But I can start with, there are a couple drugs that are actually expected to get FDA approval this year.
Let's talk about those.
Yeah, absolutely. The first one is a drug, it's called, and I may be mispronouncing it, and I'm sorry if I am, but it's I believe it's aducanumab, and it's up for FDA approval, and it is a drug called a monoclonal antibody. And what it does is it binds to the hard amyloid plaques that are the hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease. So that is up for FDA approval. They are expecting it hopefully by the spring. And if it's approved, you know, it's thought that it's going to be a game changer, because this is actually going to be the first drug shown to actually slow down the progression of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
Yes. The other drug that is under FDA review is actually not a drug that can slow down the progression. It's a drug that can possibly treat some of the more devastating symptoms of Alzheimer's disease. And it's a drug called pimavanserin, and it's an antipsychotic drug. It's already approved to treat hallucinations and delusions in people with Parkinson's, but it's under FDA review for the treatment of some of the behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia. And that's a big deal, because patients with Alzheimer's can experience dementia-related psychosis or hallucinations, and that where they can harm themselves or they can harm others. And that's one of the main reasons people with Alzheimer's can actually end up in memory care facilities. And the thought process is, if this drug is approved and it's been able to be given to patients who are displaying some of these symptoms, more people with Alzheimer's will be able to stay in their own homes.
And that would clearly be better. Hallie, the first drug you mentioned, you said it's a monoclonal antibody, and anyone who might have just tuned in might think we're talking about COVID-19.
Yeah, I know. But monoclonal antibodies are used to treat a wide array of diseases now at this point. So they're sort of a broad spectrum, and, you know, they're an exciting. And there's actually another drug that got some press recently. It's a small study that was released by drug company Eli Lilly, and their experimental drug, which is also a monoclonal antibody, also appears to slow patients' cognitive decline. So that's exciting.
There's new research, Hallie, that shows a connection between gingivitis, which is an infection in the mouth, and its connection to Alzheimer's disease.
Yes. So there is some evidence that the bacteria P. gingivitis, gingivalis, that is one of the leading causes of gum disease. There is some evidence that it can infect the brain and may actually trigger some of the changes that can cause Alzheimer's. So there is a drug that's currently in very early stage clinical trials. And the theory is that if it can inactivate gingipanes, which is the toxic proteins that the bacteria release. And it's thought that these proteins are what damage the healthy brain cells. And this is interesting, because this is really a completely new way of looking at the disease. I mean, we've known now that gum disease itself is possibly linked to heart disease and type 2 diabetes. And now there's belief that it may even be linked to Alzheimer's as well.
Holly, why do you believe it's so important for people with Alzheimer's to enroll in clinical trials?
Well, without clinical trials, we don't know, we're not going to be able to find drugs that work, honestly. And, you know, one of the things that researchers have told me over the years, one of the hardest things that they've had to deal with is a lot of times by the time patients with Alzheimer's show up at their clinics and they get the diagnosis of Alzheimer's, they are already in more advanced stages of the disease and they're not eligible for some of the clinical trials. And that's one reason why researchers are really looking for, you know, better, cheaper, and faster blood tests. Because right now there are really two main ways that researchers can diagnose Alzheimer's. You can do a PET scan to measure amounts of amyloid deposits in the brain, but that is not always easily covered by insurance. Or you can do a spinal tap, which is where they take out some of the cerebral spinal fluid and they check the amyloid levels to see, you know, just to look for changes for Alzheimer's. The problem with that is that that can be very painful and it's time consuming.
And expensive, I imagine.
Yeah. So, you know, they're really, a lot of researchers are looking into blood tests to see if we can find something earlier and diagnose people earlier so that they can be part of these clinical trials.
I had heard years ago that you really couldn't determine whether somebody actually had Alzheimer's disease until the autopsy stage, but that's not so much the case today.
Well, they can't make a definitive. My understanding is that they cannot make a definitive diagnosis until you've got the brain autopsy, but they can make a very good clinical guess just based on PET scan or spinal taps.
As a journalist who follows this, Haley, would you say this is an optimistic period moving forward?
Yeah, yes, very, very much, very much. I think you have a lot of companies investing in technology and drug therapies. You know, this is a real, this is a devastating health issue. And as people, as the baby boomers age and get older, we're going to see this even more and more. And there's a real need for it, especially since this is one of those diseases where we have not yet come up, forget even about a cure, we haven't come up really with adequate treatments to manage the disease.
Yeah. Health journalist Holly Levine, thank you so much for sharing your information with us today and this positive outlook, also your personal story as well.
Yes, thank you.
Well, you know the expression, an apple a day keeps the doctor away, right? So how closely related is our diet to our overall health and our prospects for living a long and active life? We have just the expert here this morning to help us answer that question and perhaps share some diet tips that could put you on a path to better health in 2021. Dr. Carrie Kreitzer is a registered dietitian and director of USC's Master of Science in Nutrition, Health Span, and Longevity program. She's also an associate professor in the Leonard Davis School of Gerontology at USC. Dr. Kreitzer, you're one of the state's top experts when it comes to the intersection of diet and aging, and we're very excited to have you on Insight this morning.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So what do we know about diets and longevity? Is there a best diet, you know, for good health and old age? We hear about the Mediterranean diet all the time. It's been getting headlines for years.
Yeah, definitely the Mediterranean diet. I was intrigued with Hallie's presentation looking at Alzheimer's and even just thinking about diet and its role in Alzheimer's. And it definitely is a condition that is plaguing more and more older adults. And lots of work going on looking at diet, probably Most have heard about the MIND diet, which is an attempt to really look at, can we slow the progression of Alzheimer's and dementia? One of my graduates from the program is working with Dale Bredesen on a protocol looking at the role of diet as well as lifestyle. And I think what I would really want to start with is, I don't really think of diet as the be-all, end-all. I think of diet as one piece of the equation of what is health and how do we stay healthy as we age. Certainly, I'm happy to talk about diet, but I just want to be clear that I think about stress. I think about the last speaker was talking about oral health and gingivitis, how important your oral health is to what's going on in your body. When I think about diet, I think about the gut microbiome. Is a lot of new research going into that area.
Yeah, they're showing, so doctor, that vegetarians have a completely different biome than gut biome than people who eat meat.
Yeah, you know, there's some really intriguing research coming out of the Cleveland Clinic, and it's Stan Hazen, who has been studying this byproduct of red meat digestion. And it's, if you want to look it up, it's TMAO, it's trimethylamine N-oxide, and it's the conversion of carnitine, which is a predominant protein in red meat, and the bacteria in our gut converting that protein. And his research that I think will turn us upside down with how we think about cardiovascular disease and diet. We, from my early years in the 70s and 80s, we pegged fat as the culprit for all diseases. And this TMAO is actually the protein in meat. And wouldn't that be something if we found that it wasn't just the saturated fats, but it was the protein in the red meats that we were eating? So, yes, the Mediterranean diet, we're hearing a lot about that. As we study that, I like to talk about the Mediterranean lifestyle versus just the diet, because again, it's what we do in our life, not just the food that we put in our body that really is affecting our health. And in the Mediterranean, the diet that is consumed, it is whole foods. It's not the ultra processed foods that we're buying that are canned and packaged and processed. It's foods that come from the garden. It's also lower in red meats. And some very large studies that were done with the Mediterranean diet looking at nuts and olive oil, and again, the benefits for cardiovascular disease from that diet. So more fruits and vegetables, less of the animal products, more nuts, more olive oil, beans and lentils, which is very different from our sad Western diet that many consume.
Doctor, do you think we focus so much on the diet aspect? I know you're saying it's just one piece of the puzzle, but do you think we focus so much on it because it's something we control daily? You know, we go to the grocery store, we cook our meals, we order out, all that sort of thing. And it is something that we can control. So if there is a magic pill, we want to know about it.
Right. I truly believe that we as consumers are so bombarded with advertisement, with food everywhere we turn, and we just have this overwhelming access to foods that are appealing to our taste buds, but maybe not so healthy for us. And in our fast lifestyle, we've resorted to these processed foods versus purchasing whole foods and making meals at home. But there still is time. The statistics are that we consume over 70,000 meals in our lifetime and consume about 50 tons of food.
Wow.
So while we may have had not such a good diet in our earlier years, there is time. I think what we're up against also is that we are creatures of habit. I do have a sweet tooth. I really enjoy chocolate. I'm probably more a sweet person than a savory person. And we know that high sugar intake, high salt intake, that these really can contribute to disease. So thinking back to more simplistic foods. And I think the other message is, and it's been around for many, many years, even back to Hippocrates, who said that we need to eat a variety of foods and that diet should be our medicine. We need to eat a variety of foods and not get so hung up on the same foods that we eat day after day.
Mm-hmm. So you've mentioned our Western diet and then the Mediterranean, which of course the Mediterranean encompasses portions of Europe and the Middle East and Africa. What about the diets of people who have different cultural backgrounds? How can someone who does not generally eat, say, a Eurocentric diet, keep themselves healthy while eating the foods they grew up with?
That's a great question. Thank you so much for asking that. We know from research that each of us is different genetically, and what nutrients I may need may be very different for you. And I think we do a disservice to try and convince people, for example, that immigrate to the US, that they need to eat our Western diet versus really maintaining their own cultural roots and their own cultural diet. And I think we lose what we have yet to really discover, and it is another area in infancy, really looking at our own genetics or genomics and how that relates to the actual nutrients that we need. And I think the best example is those who are able to tolerate cow's milk and can digest lactose, which is the sugar in milk. Those are predominantly Northern European ancestors, where over, millions of years, the diet adapted to enable us to consume cow's milk. Someone in an Asian culture that doesn't produce the lactase enzyme, we shouldn't be convincing them that they've got to just adapt. Genetically, they were not made to be drinking cow's milk, and soy is much more a staple in the Asian countries, a good source of calcium. So I think looking at one's own culture and genetics is important to not lose that connection. Yeah.
Doctor, I could talk to you for hours. You're so interesting. We have to have you back. Director of USC's Master of Science in Nutrition, Health Span, and Longevity Program, Dr. Carrie Kreitzer. Really appreciate you taking the time to share your knowledge with us this morning.
Sure. Happy to come back. I, too, could talk for hours about nutrition and diet and research.
Yeah, fantastic. Thank you. Still ahead, the nation's largest interdisciplinary organization devoted solely to the field of aging is now led by a woman from the Sacramento area. She joins us after the break to talk about what the focus needs to be for that organization moving forward. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. Back in just a moment. And welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Randall White. When we started the show today, we spoke with the head of California's Department of Aging about the state's new master plan for aging. On a national level, there's an organization that focuses on many of the same issues, but from an interdisciplinary perspective. It's the Gerontological Society of America, or GSA, which is much easier to say. And it's the nation's largest organization of its kind devoted to the field of aging. UC Davis Health Professor Terry Harvath is the GSA's new president. She joins us now to discuss her leadership plans during this COVID-19 pandemic and potentially during a post-COVID period. Welcome, Professor. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Randall. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, nice to see you again. So help us understand what the GSA is all about.
Certainly. Our organization is 75 years old and really focuses on supporting research, education, and clinical practice that help older adults lead more meaningful, productive lives. So it, as you said, it's interdisciplinary. We've got biologists, physiologists, nurses, physicians, sociologists, psychologists who share their collective wisdom in order to advance the field of aging.
Does it focus more on where the research is headed at, say, like universities and hospitals, or does it push more for policy changes within government, or maybe both?
It's really both. So looking at how we can foster and support more research, we have relationships with the National Institutes of Health, NIA, National Institute on Aging, and work with them on trying to identify priorities for research funding. But also the research, if it just sits on a shelf and doesn't change lives, in my mind, isn't really that beneficial. And so we also have a very distinct policy-facing arm where we're advocating for policy changes based on the best evidence available.
Mm-hmm. And so now, as you step into this leadership role as GSA president, what is important to you along those lines? Is there anything you've heard this morning that you feel needs to be forwarded?
Yes, I'm appreciated the first speaker from the Department of Aging who was talking about how ageism has continued to rear its ugly head, if you will, and have a negative impact on the lives of older adults. And we've seen that through the pandemic as well, that older adults and their family caregivers and also the professional caregiving workforce has borne a disproportionate burden of the illness and negative impacts of the pandemic. And so part of what we do at GSA is we've got an initiative on reframing aging that really looks at aging in a different light and recognizes that, as that speaker said, and I think you said at the beginning, we are all aging.
Right.
That starts from the moment we're born. And to understand that age brings both challenges and benefits, and that the wisdom that we often think of that older adults have is an important part of the cumulative knowledge and experience that we get over our lives. And so looking at how ageism can be identified and dismantled so that we do a better job of providing the care for older adults and their families, that I think is really important.
Professor Peter wrote in, who is an occupational therapist, and I'm going to try to boil this down as much as I can, said, one of the most frustrating aspects for rehab professionals is that our patients could have used these services long before whatever event it was that led them to the hospital. But the healthcare payment structure is oriented towards sick care. Is this an issue that your organization is looking at?
Yes, it absolutely is. We see this in a variety of ways. We see this in health policy, for example, for family caregivers, where we for decades have ignored the essential contribution that families have made to care of older adults, hoping that they will continue to do it rather than seeing them as part of the workforce that we need to ensure that older adults stay out of the emergency rooms and out of hospitals and out of those places where sick care happens. We spend a disproportionate amount of our healthcare budget during the last 6 months of an older person's life with tremendously invasive procedures and hospitalizations that don't really add to the quality of their life and are not necessarily what they would have chosen. but we don't spend that time in pre-planning, advanced care planning, and identifying what is really important to this individual. And one of the other movements that is happening nationally is the age-friendly health system. And it's based on the four M's: what matters, medication, mentation, and mobility. And for the occupational therapist, yes, keeping older adults more mobile at home, but also when they're in the hospital, is an important part of their wellness. But it all starts with understanding what matters. And we don't do a good job of identifying what matters to older adults as they age. And therefore, we tend to respond and react to illness rather than prepare and keep people well and provide care that supports their quality of life rather than just treating symptoms and illness.
On that caregiver note, let's talk a little bit about your role here in Sacramento. You are the director of the Family Caregiving Institute at the Betty Irene Moore School of Nursing at UC Davis. Help walk us through that. What are the main issues when it comes to caregiving?
Mm-hmm. Family caregivers tend to be the invisible part of our healthcare system. They're absolutely essential to the care of older adults, but we often don't see them. The Family Caregiving Institute is focused on enhancing research that helps family caregivers, particularly family caregivers from groups that have been understudied, minority LGBTQ caregivers. We're also looking at enhancing the workforce and their ability to partner more effectively with family caregivers. They need to see family caregivers as part of that interdisciplinary team that's caring for older adults. And because UC Davis is launching a new aging initiative, we're going to start providing direct care services for family caregivers to look at ways in which we can be supportive of families by helping them be more prepared for the role of caregiving, to take care of themselves while they're caring for a family member, and to manage the stress that is an inevitable part of providing care to a frail older family member.
Because your knowledge is so broad when it comes to the topic of aging, I'm curious, how much do we have control over what our golden years will be like? Is it all baked into a genetic cake, or can we dramatically alter it with some well-planned frosting when we're younger, even as children?
Yeah, I think as the dietitian was talking about, there are behavior and lifestyle changes that we can make that help us age in a more healthful way. Certainly, there are some things that we're not going to have control over, you know, genetically based illnesses, disadvantages that come from the social determinants of health that are not under the individual's control. But by, you know, diet and exercise, it does, you know, sort of come back to those things. My mom is 89 years old, and she does exercise and lifts weights every day except for Sunday. She takes Sundays off. And she'll tell you that exercise is as much fun at 89 as it was at 45, which is not too much. And yet she does it, and she's living alone. She's able to, you know, manage her household. She goes up and down steps to do laundry in the basement. And by maintaining activity, both physical activity, but also brain activity, right, we can have a positive influence on how we age.
Mm-hmm. I believe that strongly, too. My mom will be 89 later this year, takes a daily walk, you know, through the neighborhood, and lives an active life socially as well, which has been really difficult during the pandemic. And I wish we had time to get into that, but we don't. UC Davis Health Professor Terry Harvath, the new president of the Gerontological Society of America, really appreciate you taking the time to share your thoughts with us this morning.
Thank you, Randall. Thanks for your interest in this topic. It's an important one.
Each guest, I could have gone on longer. Yeah, you've all been terrific. Thank you so much. And that is Insight for today. Learn more at capradio.org/insight. Thanks to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, managing editor Aram Sarkissian, our digital team, Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minotta. Technical director is Mark Jones. And engineer, if I can see through the glass correctly, is Devin Cortan. Joe Barr is is CAP Radio's Chief Content Officer. I'm Randall White. Thanks for joining us this morning. Tomorrow on Insight, we dig into the problems plaguing California's Employment Development Department when we speak with the head of the EDD and a state legislator who is one of the state's top critics of that department. You won't want to miss this.